And welcome to the Senate Special Committee on Revenue. Members, we have some housekeeping to take care of in the form of adoption of the committee rules. These committee rules are consistent with committee rules that have been used for the revenue committees in the first and second special sessions. If you'd just like to take a moment and glance at them, the chair would accept a motion to adopt the Special Committee on Revenue Rules.
So moved.
We have a motion to adopt the Senate Special Committee on Revenue Rules as printed. Are there any questions in motion or discussion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered, rules are adopted. Committee, we have a couple of pieces of business to do today, and actually one that may be coming our way in a few minutes. But what has been asked for is a recapitulation of what it is that we're trying to accomplish in this special session. The governor's called us to deal with a revenue shortfall. There's been a lot of spreadsheets and calculations circulated about how big is the revenue shortfall and where it comes from. There's also been some discussion about what potential sources of revenue are out there. So we've asked staff to do the official USDA choice version of what is the existing gap in our revenue, and what are the deficit calculations on, and what are they based upon. And I'll just go ahead and let Paul Warner walk us through the gap calculations and the things that have changed since the last special session. Sorry, Mr. Warner, it's up to you.
Mr. Chair, you might guess we've been staring at these numbers for quite a while now. But what we've tried to provide you is a sense of how things have changed since the special session to get kind of a common beginning point. And, you know, how we define the size of the problem makes certain assumptions, too, and I'll describe that in a minute. One way to reduce the gap, in other words, is to reduce the size of the problem, and you can make decisions that would go in that direction as well. What I've done is look at the gap from the standpoint of addition since the special session, in terms of calculating back from the deficit, and then in terms of what possible solutions have been discussed, and this is by no means all possible solutions. It's just more or less a compendium of things we've been keeping track of and that we have a fair amount of information on. If you look at the gap itself and the calculation, one of the things you'll notice about the June revenue forecast is it shows a $505 million decrease in the general fund projection from March. Well, there was also $40 million general fund increase from actions that you took during the special session. Now, the largest being a transfer of $20 million from the senior deferral property tax program balance into the general fund. So those actions, if you include those, the forecast is actually down $545. Another element included here is federal legislation passed on March 9, which allowed bonus depreciation the first year on qualified equipment purchases. That's for a three-year window beginning retroactive to September 10, 2001. That adds, that's 124 of the 545. So that's included in that number. Now, on the school side, there is a state school fund disappropriation in the budget right now, a $200 million disappropriation that was part of the second special session. So if you take no actions there, that will be carried out. That, however, excludes the $20 million that was to be increased to the school fund if Measure 13 passed. Okay, so Measure 13 is not in here, just the $200 million disappropriation. The governor vetoed some revenue sources, and then through the allotment process was going to make $81 million in reductions. However, those allotment reductions were not made, so that $81 million is back in the budget. What we don't have in terms of the balance is the $81 million in revenue to balance it. So we've got to add that 81 to the problem. 20 of that was from the state school fund. So that, if this entire gap is restored, the $859 million, that would leave the state school fund down $112 million from the school improvement fund reduction that was done in the special session. So I want to make clear that understanding is there. That's part of the 859. So if you get to the 859 and you restore the 200 disappropriation, then the school improvement fund is eliminated or for the second year, but the state school fund would be at the same level as the approved level. Another way to come at that same gap is to look at the deficit, which is $551 million right now. The ending balance at the close of the special session, what you thought you had left in that ending balance was $76 million. Then there's $33 million in the rebalance from DHS and HIPAA. And that brings you up to $660 million. If you add the $200 million from the disappropriation from the state school fund, you're back to $860 million. So you can calculate the gap either way. You get to the same answer, whether you start with a deficit or you start with a decrease in the forecast. Now, in terms of the possible solutions, these are listed in no particular order, just how they've appeared in our spreadsheet and discussion. Some of the numbers can be adjusted, can be increased. Some of them can certainly be decreased. The simplest way to look at a temporary tax rate increase would be a one-year increase in the rates of 10%, go to 557799 for 1 year. That would generate $466 million. That's roughly a 10% increase. The tobacco settlement revenue, which you had used $60 million of in the last special session, but that was vetoed by the governor. So there's $82 million that is now directed to the health trust fund. That 82 could be reallocated, or up to 87 actually, could be reallocated for general purposes. We've recommended a $5 million ending balance there because of the uncertainty around the volume adjustment on the amount of money we'll get from the tobacco companies. Those payments, by the way, come in April and come in January and April. So we'll get two more payments this biennium. The general fund ending balance is 76, and that's part of that 859 gap. So if you wanted to restore that, that would be part of the gap. But you also can use that general fund money to help fill the 859 gap.
Paul, the general fund ending balance also includes contingencies on scheduled expenses. For instance, would it be the E-Board or the general fund that would have to pay for the cost of fire suppression if we have a very bad fire year?
Mr. Chair, normally we think of those from that E-Fund, that general purpose E-Fund. And that's the next item there, and that's the $32 million. So that would be the general purpose non-committed E-Fund. There is still some special purpose E-Fund money, particularly the supplemental E-Fund money for salaries.
Does that take all the E-Fund that's available?
The 32 would take the entire amount.
Okay, I guess I believe Senator Trow's thinking along the same lines that I'm hoping he is, that allocation of the entire E-Board fund leaves us without essentially our self-insurance fund for forest fires and other necessary reserves.
Those things are not already purchased.
No, and we don't have insurance. We self-insure.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I agree. Because we're responsible up to, I don't remember what it is, but there's a dollar amount, and I think Lloyd's of London kicks in after we hit that dollar amount. But we're in a recession. We know caseloads are going to be up. You know it. So to cut us down to zero doesn't make sense.
So I guess the point is that in presenting this option to our colleagues in the building, we ought to have at least a caveat that they understand that utilization of this entire E-Board balance would leave us without any contingency fund for fire or additional services that are necessary.
Can I ask, is $32 million what's left?
$32 million is what's left in the general purpose E-Fund, yes. So I think, and the same could be said of the general fund ending balance. When you think of those as part of a solution, normally it's thought of as a part of those numbers, as a portion of it.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Doesn't the ending balance then convert to what's available to us at the beginning of next session? So, is this 76, all of that?
No.
So we would start out with no reserves at the beginning of...
Other things go into the beginning balance besides this, so it's usually bigger than that. And there'll be some other things.
Okay.
That will flow.
Well, the beginning balance specifically would include any reversions.
Yeah.
That come out of the general fund.
Aren't we cutting all of those out of the budget?
Most of them are.
What time is it?
It's not going to be very big, you're right.
But Senator Dukes, you're absolutely right. There is a very strong link between what you leave as an ending balance here and what you'll ultimately have for planning for 0305.
Okay, and I think that Senator Dukes' point is that as long as we're explaining the ramifications to people, the caveat ought to be that if your ending balance is used entirely in allocation, you carry nothing over into the next session.
I don't know what that does to our cash flow. I know what local government, they have to have something where they end up, because they rely on property taxes. We don't. I have no idea what our cash flow from federal and other places is in terms of income tax, in terms of whether they end up borrowing if they don't have it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the state treasurer
has been doing that.
Made some incursions into that territory in the last special session. Mm-hmm. We had to take some precipitous action to prevent having to borrow in the last special session. So. Let's proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
While we're on the point of the E-Fund, are there any other reserves in the E-Fund that are not mentioned or shown here?
These are the only
special purpose funds that I know of. There may be others, and I can check with the legislature.
Okay, what I'm suggesting is that there are other reserves that we can divert. It may not make some constituent groups happy, but...
Senator, thanks for the question. I assumed that what we were looking at was all of the nooks and crannies in the cookie jars, so let's get them all if we can. Thank you, Mr. Warren.
And on that line, I have another one if I can throw it out here. Mm-hmm. I think the governor just announced a hiring freeze. Mm-hmm. Has anyone done a calculation on any expected savings of a hiring freeze?
Senator Minnis, the legislative fiscal has looked at that. I'm not sure if they have specific numbers, but they have looked at that and the impact of the hiring freeze and made assumptions about what the or estimates about what the vacancy rate is and what the normal rate of attrition would be, and that would be the key determinant. But we do have some estimates on that.
And it would be helpful, I think, to get at least some preliminary numbers of what that means or what doesn't mean.
The next item there is one that is just a tax rate chosen. This is the one that is, and I haven't gotten my bill numbers down yet, but is in the House bill now before the House Budget Reconciliation Committee. Would be a 75-cent cigarette tax increase starting July 1. Collections would begin July 1. We did have in our earlier estimates inclusion of a floor tax. Our advice now from council is that we could not impose a floor tax or an inventory tax before the effective date of the measure. So that would be 90 days after it passed. So therefore, the collections could begin on July 1, but no floor tax could be imposed. And that revenue estimate is $109 million with collections beginning the higher collection rate beginning on July 1.
Does the estimate include the floor tax or not?
Does not include the floor tax, Senator, because our advice is that we couldn't impose it.
Okay.
And the question came up about the relative rates at which tobacco would be used if a higher tax was imposed. Mm-hmm. And so there would be a relative decline in utilization, mm-hmm. and that would have a negative effect on revenue, and I wondered if that was calculated in the $109 million.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have what we call our elasticity response, and it's really built around the three elements. One is the historical response. We've had the price increases through the impact on sales in Oregon, and we have a pretty good estimate of that. We do have quite a bit of debate about how much of that is actual decrease in smoking. versus how much of it is smoking of non-tax cigarettes, but we know the relationship between the tax cigarettes and prices. The other thing that we have tried to do with when the gaps develop between our neighboring states, such as Washington's imposition of a $1.42 tax on January 1st, is to include that, and that's also what we call our border effect. And we've gone through and estimated particularly what percentage of the population is in border areas that may be affected. California also is looking at a significantly higher cigarette tax. They're currently at 87 cents.
So Senator Dukes tells me that the maritime shipping in her county would increase dramatically as a result of that.
I don't know about that, but I've never forgotten the one little drive-through cigarette shop I've got. I mean, literally, you don't get out of your car, you drive across the bridge into Oregon, you drive through the cigarette shop, and back to Washington.
Differential, then, we are at, what, 68 cents a pack at the present?
Yes.
And we would be adding 75 cents under this proposal for a total of, what, $1.43?
$1.43 would bring us just about even with Washington. California has, Governor Davis has proposed a 50-cent increase, which would put them at $1.37. So they're at 87 cents now.
And Idaho remains at 28 cents a pack.
Idaho's at 28 cents a pack. I don't see anything about it.
Stimulating traffic through Baker.
This is what you know, economic development, right?
Just done in connection with toll bridges might be, well.
There you go.
The next item we have is the 911 balance. So the portion we have been working with is $19 million. Those dollars are dollars that come from the excise tax during the current biennium. They are not allocated to a specific purpose this biennium. There is, however, a planned usage of a good portion of those funds for equipment purchases in the following biennium. So there is a trade-off. Obviously, what you use now would not be available for purchases in the following biennium. You have passed a bill twice now, in both special sessions, that would pull $14 million from that balance and use it for general purposes this biennium. The governor has vetoed the bill each time.
Senator Minnis, is there we've heard some discussion about law enforcement purposes to which these funds might be put that might reduce the availability to $7 million, and perhaps the question is better directed to Paul Warner. Paul, should we look at this as $19 million unallocated, or is it really $7 million usable and some potential needs that have been expressed for the balance?
Mr. Chair, the governor has publicly agreed to $7 million. So we know that he would not veto $7 million. So that would clearly be something that would be acceptable to him.
Okay, and the $19 million is unallocated, meaning the legislature has never earmarked or committed any of those dollars.
Right, correct. Okay.
You know there's need for every dollar out there.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to your question is the law enforcement community and those groups would tend to disagree with spending the money in a way other than what's currently being spent.
Yeah.
There,
so.
Mr. Chair?
Senator?
I think it's reasonable to point out that when the people who paid their bills paid this money, they just sort of assumed that it was going to go to 911.
Yes.
Not into the state
point?
General fund.
All right. Here's one of the perennial favorites. It's retiming.
Mr. Chair, this is actually the bill that's before you now has grown out of this discussion of the timing of school payments. I have 211 here because that's the number we've worked with, which is 1/12 of the legislatively approved state school fund. And another way of looking at this is to use a timing mechanism to make funds available to the school districts early next biennium in place of the $200 million disappropriation.
Mm.
So you can look at it in either way. In that case, there would be 200 that would be part of the solution. Generally, and Steve will go through the bill. Steve and Cindy are here with you to go through the bill that proposes to provide a double payment on July 15, 2003, and allow schools, permit schools, to accrue up to 8% of their school fund, state school fund appropriation this coming school year, accrue 8% of that July 15 payment back to this year to meet expenses that arise after the biennium ends but are accrued back to the following year. So that bill will be before you shortly. That would provide a reduction in the state budget because we operate on a cash basis. The districts operate on an accrual basis, and there would be a different impact on them. In terms of the Common School Fund, we have spent a good deal of time looking at this issue. I've put $115 million there. That's the amount that we think can be identified roughly to statutory sources, which would be the unclaimed property account. There's an inflow into that account and an outflow, but a net inflow of about $10 million a year, gross inflow of about $20. And the fund now is about $125 million. And that fund, you could borrow against that fund. We would recommend leaving at least $10 million there in case there was, for some reason, a reversal between the size of the outflow and inflow in a given year. The 115 could be borrowed if you borrow against the statutory amount of the fund. We think council advises us conditions are pretty much determined by the legislature, conditions of repayment. We don't even think it's legal necessarily to repay it if it's from a statutory source. From a constitutional source, which is about the other $650 million of the fund, those constitutional sources, the opinion we get from the AG is they could be borrowed, but there would have to be a laid-out repayment plan, and that repayment return would have to be determined in an arm's-length way, some kind of a market rate of return that would equal what investment opportunities the fund would have. So there would be clearly a much stricter borrowing guidelines if you were to borrow from the constitutional portion versus the statutory portion.
All right, so the 115
is the statutory portion.
But we would be retaining 10 in the statutory portion as a reserve?
Yes, the 10 would be a reserve because the state is obligated to pay unclaimed property claims. And the net inflow into the fund is the sale of those properties. And if it's claimed, then, of course, then there's an outflow. Usually there's a positive net inflow, but there should be some balance in case there's a reversal of that.
Okay. So the policy question is whether these funds would be used at all, and if they were determined to be used, would they be simply distributed without requirement for repayment, or would the legislature determine that it was a form of borrowing? And in any case, the remainder of the portion that is constitutional could be borrowed, but it would have to be at market rate.
Yes.
In an arm's length process.
Yes.
Okay. And the repayment has been what suggested that we make the repayment out of the very last school payment that's made. Never mind.
In the last biennium.
Yes. In the very last biennium.
Mr. Chair, the other things, and I probably should have ordered these in a little bit more logical way, but I did put in a 4% corporate personal income tax surcharge, which would generate $240 million. A surcharge is just taking whatever your tax liability is and multiplying it by a percentage, in this case 4%. So this is exactly the way the kicker works, only in this case it would be a surcharge rather than a refund. And that gives you a sense of what could be generated in that manner. Implementation of Measure 88, which was now in effect for the 2002 tax year, will bump the allowable subtraction for federal taxes from $3,000 to $5,000. We estimate that if that were not in effect this tax year and 2004 or 2003, in other words, they got a two-year delay there, you'd generate about $133 million more in revenue this biennium, plus about another $62 next biennium. Measure 13, of course, the previous version that failed at the polls had $220 million transfer. You could go up to that amount, or obviously any amount below that would be feasible. There is about $278 million in the endowment fund by the end of this biennium. And any transfer from the endowment fund to the state school fund would take place at the end of this biennium, so it would be part of the last payment in the biennium. There are a large number of possibilities on tobacco securitization. I just plugged in a simple number here that's related to a number to a bill that passed the House in the first special session, did not pass the Senate in the second special session. And this one would generate $200 million in cash available now and would have a debt service cost of about $34 million per a year, or $68 million for the 03-05 biennium. That would leave about $41 million unpledged. In the last session, pledged a portion of the settlement money for OHSU bonds, revenue bonds. The other items there, a beer and wine tax increase. This is the governor's proposal from the last special session. We've assumed that a September 1st start date, so you basically have 9 months of collections at $27 million for the beer and wine proposal. The emergency fund had allocated $100 million for salaries, roughly half and half salaries and benefits, and that $100 million has not been discharged by the e-board yet. So it is technically there in the e-fund right now, $100 million. So,
Senator Dukes.
May I ask, how much of that is tied up in contracts?
Those dollars, that $100 million is basically 80% of it is tied to the contracts, to staff that are under union contract that's been negotiated and is allocated. Would take $80 million to meet that allocation. Roughly $20 million would be management.
Okay.
There is a housing reserves. I know there's been a lot of numbers on this. We identified about $19 million in what we call unrestricted housing reserves in the last special session. Those are reserves above what we call restricted reserves, which are required to meet certain conditions for the housing authority to sell bonds. The $16 million, we took $3 million basically in the special session package last time, so that number is now $16 million. If you add all of those up, and some of them, of course, are really not appropriately added because we've got a surcharge and a rate increase and everything, but if you added all of those together, you'd have about $1.9
billion,
which is about twice the size of the gap, but nonetheless, as I say, some of those are not things you could add together.
And I think the point of this recapitulation is to try to get folks to look at what's real and to focus on what's possible and what's doable. For instance, the tobacco securitization has been the one that has been consistently promised to be vetoed throughout the discussions with the governor. So you can look at it as $200 million in potential revenue, but you probably can't get it past the guy in the middle of the building. The salary and bonus, or the salary reserves in the e-fund are contractually obligated, and that means that the agencies would still be contractually obligated to deliver those increases to their employees. Right. But if the agencies didn't get the allocation from the e-board, then they would be required to reduce program by $100 million in order to meet their contractual obligations. So that $100 million, maybe a way of doing a reduction in agency funding and a sort of inducing the agency to participate in the reduction by having them make the choices about where those reductions come. They would not come in salaries since those are contractually obligated.
But Mr. Chair, it would be indiscriminate and we would have no control over what programs were cut.
That's true. That is true.
A lot of budgets are in bad shape already.
And then relative to Measure 13, many will wonder if we were to refer that why we didn't read the newspaper recently. So I think there are several here that deserve an asterisk in explanation. And part of the reason for being here today is to discuss those real potentials. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I've heard the housing reserve reported at $125 million. But you're indicating that the unrestricted reserve is 16 million.
Yes, that's our understanding.
So we've got folks doing their own spreadsheet laptop budgets. They're using numbers that simply will not be without some considerations. And I'm getting requests from folks just to put out something that people can use to push the numbers around that seems real. That is to list the possibilities, but also list the caveats and restrictions.
Chair.
Senator Crowe.
Just a question. Have our attorneys looked at, if we borrow from the Common School Fund, whether or not there would be grounds for litigation, and would we get sued, and any kind of situation because of that?
Senator, we have looked at this issue going back actually to January, and we do have some disagreement over the constitutional portion of that fund between the Attorney General's office and our legislative council. There does appear to be agreement, certainly on the statutory portion, the 115 we have there, that legally it could be borrowed and could be repaid in a way defined by the legislature. Legislature could not obligate general fund to repay that, but could designate a revenue source to do that. That's not to say that we wouldn't get sued or litigated, because I'm sure that that's always a possibility, but that it was the consensus between council and Attorney General's office that that statutory portion could be borrowed.
We had the same assurances about the safe borrowing a few sessions back as well.
Is that an editorial?
We got sued and we did lose.
Is that an editorial on term limitations?
No, I don't know.
Institutional memory will be shorter.
That's right.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator.
Paul, prior to the first special session, we had a revenue options committee. We had a couple of pages of various things. I would like another copy of that. I don't know about other members. I'm going to see what else is on that list.
I will make that available to all the committee. We still have that, and actually most of these things have come from that list.
Sure they have.
And we've kind of winnowed that down, but that is a broader list.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you. Tobacco securitization, that is future monies. We have the 82 in hand right now in tobacco settlement. The 200 would be an estimate of what we might get selling off the future. And what is the 68 million and there and 40.7 million unpledged?
Senator Fisher, the securitization would be for $200 million available now in the current biennium to pay current obligations. It would require a diversion of that flow coming into the state, master settlement monies, which are about $90 million a year. Require a diversion of that beginning in 03. And the 03 amount that would have to be diverted to pay off the 200 would be $34 million per year.
Oh, so that's
68 million.
Biennium.
Yes, at 68 million for 03-05. And the 41 million is the amount that we estimate that would be unpledged after you've diverted this for securitization purposes, after you've paid off the OHSU revenue bonds. You'd have 41 million left for next biennium to allocate for general purposes.
And, Paul, the life of those revenue bonds would be, what, 10 years?
Those would be 10 years, and the so-called turbo bonds would actually be less than that, be about 8 years.
Okay, so you'd be looking at least a 10-year situation, borrowing $200 million and paying back $350
million. Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, this 200 number, it can be increased depending on if you're willing to commit longer stream. For example, we've had estimates out to 20 years, and you can generate over $600 million if you're willing to go out that far.
Any further questions on this worksheet? I want to thank you, Paul, for helping us get a handle on the real numbers. And I just want to point out that at least on the ending balance and the E-Fund and the 911 funds and the retiming issue, since that number's changed since the last time we saw it. The distributions from the Common School Fund, Measure 13, and the salary freeze, all of those, in my opinion, ought to have at least an asterisk, because they need some explanations. The rest seem to be relatively straightforward, either reserves that we have available or tax proposals. Any further questions about this recapitulation?
Go over that one more time, it was asked.
I was looking at the ending balance, because that has an implication for the next biennium, as one that would be asterisk. E-fund would eliminate firefighting capability and emergencies. 911 funds at 19 million may obviate some requests and requirements that law enforcement may have for those funds that are probably known to folks if we did some digging. The retiming has been discussed at 200 million pretty consistently in budget presentations that I've seen. It's possibly 211 million, so that would be an increase.
Mr. Chair, if I could clarify that, I think what you've seen is a proposal that basically would allow the $200 million disappropriation to remain in place,
mm-hmm.
and then change the payment schedule,
mm-hmm.
and some give some guidance as to accounting practices that would allow up to $200 to be accrued back to this biennium.
Okay.
So the $200 disappropriation would simply be allowed to stand, and that would negate that piece of the problem.
It would wash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. We've heard the Common School Fund described at $125 million as being the statutory portion. But we do have some obligation for cash flow management.
The 125 is correct.
Right, so 115 might be the total amount available. Measure 13 with 220s, just simply point out it's been rejected by the voters as a strategy. And then the salary issue, there are contractual obligations for the $100 million. So if that were used as a proposal, it would end up requiring the agencies to direct the cuts, but still they would have to meet their contractual obligations or face litigation. And so those, at least in my mind, add up to caveats. The other one is that there is an unrestricted and a restricted portion of the housing reserve, and the unrestricted portion is $16 million rather than the total housing reserve, which I've characterized it about to. Is it $200 million or is it?
I've seen $149 million, Mr. Chair, in their financial statements. But that would include the restriction portion.
Right. So that if you just add all these sources up, you come to $1.93 billion, and in fact, not all of those resources are available. And I just want to make sure that people have those caveats when they do their own balance sheet. Other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Warner. What we'll do is I will announce that we have had additional postings that as of about 4 o'clock, the Senate Bill 1021 was posted for hearing after 4:15, and that is the PERS bill, and that is the one that many of you are here to hear. So that it has been posted, and we will be hearing that bill today. The first order of business would be to hear Senate Bill 1022, and we'll have Steve make that presentation. I misspoke myself. Senate Bill 1021 is the first bill, and that has been posted for hearing any time after 4:15. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Or staff. Steve, Senate Bill 1022. I have had so many questions about how what the mechanism is and how it works, and if this is merely an accounting practice, will the lack of moving these payments forward create real dislocations in education funding? Is this a gimmick? Is this a strategy? Is it real? What is it? And I guess it's your responsibility to make sense of this for the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dugan.
Slowly in small words.
Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, Steve Meyer, the State Revenue. Cindy Hunt is here to help me do, try to answer some of the questions that you have proposed. Let's just start with going through what's in the bill itself. If, for those that don't have a copy of the bill yet, it's LC number 17, in terms of the LC draft. That's what I have marked up. What the bill is addressing or is dealing with in general is making some changes to how school, what the finance options that school districts have, and education service districts as well. So keep in mind that it applies to both of those groups. The first thing that you see in Section 1 is a change in the payment schedule of state school funds to school districts. Recall in House Bill 4011, I believe it was, in the second special session, you changed the payment schedule to be 8 1/3% per month for each of the 12 months. But what you see in Section 1 is to modify that slightly and make a double payment in effect in July of 16 2/3%, and then no May payment. And that would begin in 0203, excuse me, 0304, right. So that there would be more money at the beginning of the school year. And you know, that may become clear as we proceed. So that's the first change. Secondly, in Section 4,
is that on a biennial basis? You do that every 2 years?
That's
one time every 2 years?
No, that would be continuous.
Continuous. You do it every year. So every year, no May payment and a double payment in July.
Correct.
Okay. No June payment.
No June payment.
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, in Sections 4 and 5 and 6 on page 2, make some changes in other financing methods that school districts and education service districts use. Section 4 applies to debt obligations issued and when they have to be repaid. Currently, they have to be repaid within 12 months. This allows an extension of an additional month so that they would have 13 months between the issue date and when they would have to be paid. That would allow it to overlap fiscal years. This is the intent there. And that would apply to debt obligations issued after the effective date of the act and prior to July 1st, 2005. Section 5 deals with districts that are on an accrual accounting basis, and it would let them accrue from one fiscal year back to the preceding fiscal year, with the accrual not exceeding 8% of the district's state school fund grant. So it would allow them to basically add revenue to the current year from the succeeding year.
And see, that approximates the periodic payments to the other school districts at 8.5%.
Right. It coincides with the double payment in July. So if they want to draw an additional month into this year and repay it with out of their double payment in July, they could do that.
Is that 8% sufficient to take care of all their needs to do that?
Well, it's not intended to take care of all their needs, I'm sure.
Well, but if they're limited to that, if they don't have it, then they're not able to. They're on an accrual basis. They're on an accrual basis for some reason. They must be already accruing things.
Yeah.
Yep. Now we're going to have this payment shift.
Yes.
And what I'm asking is this adequate? Is the 8% adequate for them to do both?
We can ask the school districts themselves, but I think when we went through this potential in the second special session, there was quite a bit of research done with roughly 40 districts that are on the accrual method. Mm-hmm. And I think the consensus among the districts was that they could cope with this issue.
I think the accrual districts probably can. I just wonder if the 8% is enough. I'm not sure about the smaller districts or the cash districts and what they do.
Okay, Section 6 tries to address the cash accounting basis districts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Section 6 says that if the district is on a cash basis, then it can have a negative ending fund balance for a fiscal year, and that applies to the 02-03 fiscal year.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Duke.
Member, I'm the one who asked for short words and easy explanation. 5 and 6 mean that they can spend in June and pay in July?
In fact, yes. In simple words.
You know.
Let's see. Let me make sure that I have the timing right on Section 6 in terms of when they can have that negative ending balance. That starts in 02-03 and is repealed January 1, 2006. So there's a limited number of years for them to do that. Mm-hmm. So
they have to make the transition and flatten out their accruals.
Part of the reason is to not encourage a cash basis beyond a certain length of time when you have the accrual provisions.
And we're referring to the negative ending fund balance of the American plan.
What happens if they have one that's over 8%? Does the bill speak to that? A negative fund balance?
It does not.
So what happens?
They would be in violation of other statutes.
They would probably receive a sharply worded letter from the senator.
Okay.
Except I'm not sure who writes the
letter. Mr. Chair, Senator Trow.
Yeah.
I think in their audited statement, there would be a sharply worded statement.
Absolutely.
There's also a statute that Steve's going to get to next that talks about public officials spending money they don't have and how they can get in trouble around that.
Okay.
So there's some ramifications.
Okay.
This may be instructed to the committee.
Section 9 then deals with what Cindy was just talking about. You have the new language in Section 4, which allows the districts to do the negative ending balance and the accrual across fiscal years. And then Section 10 removes 4B after the January 1, 2006 sunset date. But it still allows the accrual change to continue.
And I guess I'll ask Cindy and you, Steve, it's anticipated that the school districts will transition into this system and eventually even out and essentially mirror the same distributions that are made with the other districts at 8 1/3%. Is that sort of, or are we going to have to, at some point in time, extend the sunset date?
Well, it gives them a period of time to try to spread additional expenditures and make up for that over a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that happens or not,
okay.
They could, at the end of that 5-year period, they could end up being where they are now.
All right. Ms. Sense, do you have any clarifications? And I'll remind you that Senator Dukes has asked for
short
monosyllabic. Oh, I'm sorry. Short word.
Short word.
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, we are scheduled to go into a public hearing on this bill, so I think maybe we had better ask if anyone has signed up to testify on this.
I noticed they hadn't. Let me look.
Oh, we have one in the audience. Generic sign-up form. Please come forward, Mr. Rose, and be recognized. We are in public hearing. Mr. Marshall, you are also invited to come forward to offer testimony. they're not checks.
I was going to say, they're saving paper.
Actually, I printed it twice. I even cut, excuse me.
Proceed when ready, sir.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 22. And I'm sure in special session you heard us talk about not liking the shift idea, and I want to know, I want you to know that I don't have the opinion that this is the way to solve Oregon's long-term problems. I think we ought to have more money for schools and a different tax structure. But having said that, here we are today trying to solve some problems. And what I want to talk to you is how to try to make this work to help solve your problem. That's why my talking points say accelerated and delayed payment. This process is referred to by some as an accelerated payment. For some of the rest of us, it's a delayed payment. But now, how do you make it work? We think it can work. We think that the four things that I've listed here are very important, and part of them are addressed and part of them aren't, and I'd like to talk to you about that. First, we need to, in Section 5 and 6, do this, create the language to allow for the accrual for accounting purposes, because if we don't do that, it's not there, and auditors won't allow it. I still think the auditors, because of Gatsby, will write little notes that you shouldn't do this, but we will be able to say, now, having said that, the law says we can do this for this purpose. And so I think that's important. The second issue, extending the TANs bar in a period of 13 months, which is IRS standard. Steve opened his remarks by noting that this makes changes in financial options for school districts. We think it does, but we don't think you ought to delete it. To stop it after one go-around. We would ask that you delete Section 4, Sub 2, and leave that TANs operation on the table permanently. If it's a good idea to expand options, let local boards. And there's no reason to sunset that or delete that option after this one go-around. And it would then be consistent with what the federal IRS standards are also. The third issue for us will be assure that this amount that we're advancing or delaying, whatever you want to call it, is included in the base 2001-2003 budget base for DSL purposes for determining the 2003-2005 budget. Many people talk about if we do this, where it's a cut, we're going to lose the money. It's not a cut, and we don't lose the money if every subsequent biennium this process is followed. And the only way we assure that that is followed is if the base that we start from in 2001-2003 isn't reduced by this particular activity. I don't think it takes legislation necessarily to do that. It takes a budget note or something to, and then we'll be back in 0305 arguing over the appropriation it takes to meet CSL. That's fine. That's what we do all the time. But I think it's very important that it's clear that this amount of money, 200 or 211 or whatever the number is part of our base in the 0103 budget for that purpose. The last item isn't addressed in this bill, and it could be, and I think it should be, and this is how do we treat the distribution of the money that is going to be distributed in the 2003 school year. Under current law, you would distribute the 16 2/3% of the state school fund in August. Then in October and for the subsequent 7 months, you would distribute 8 1/3%, and then in May, the balance, which is approximately 25%. And if we don't make some kind of a statement, the amount you'll be distributing will be those percentages applied to the state school fund minus the $200 million that we're going to get in the next budget year. In other words, the cut is going to start in August in terms of our cash flow and so forth, how districts are run. And we're borrowing the money at the end of the year. That's where the cut ought to come. And so we would ask that you would adjust the language that says those 16 2/3, 8 1/3% apply to the legislative approved budget at the end of session, or legislative approved amount for the state school fund at the end of the regular session. And then the balance be paid out in May, and the May payment would be $200 million short. That's the money we're going to borrow against if we need to borrow, and some districts won't need to borrow, but that's the money you're borrowing against and getting returned in the July payment.
And I think that's a fair treatment. And it will also let districts start managing their cash flow and preparing for that. And not all districts are going to have to borrow the entire amount. Not all districts are going to have to borrow the amount for the entire 60 days from May 15th to July 15th. And they're going to have a year to start working on how do you manage that to reduce the cost of this. And then once we're in this process, it will continue ad infinitum with the rest of the bill, and it will work if you make the little tiny changes that we ask you to make.
Questions from the committee? Senator Mann?
Help me understand this base issue. It sounded kind of like a who's on first question to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mann, when we start, when they build a budget for 2003-2005, you will build a current service level budget and start talking about what's it take for 2003-2005 based on what happened in 2000. And you will roll up our expenditures based on anticipated increase in students.
If I'm understanding correctly, you're suggesting that by doing this now, we're reducing your budget by $200 million, and that would be the base for the next biennium?
I want to be sure that you don't do it that way, right?
Right.
That's all.
Okay.
If we weren't doing this, when you start looking at the CSL, that'll happen. And the argument that you're eventually, we're going to lose this money, it is a cut, because you go look at the state school, and it's $200 million short of what it was. That, by the way, is a cut. What we're working on is what is a practical way to not make it be a cut in implementing the programs in school districts.
I understand what you're doing.
And I don't think it takes statute. I think it takes maybe a budget note or some very clear understanding and that people can't back away from. Because then we're just going to be in the argument of how much, what's the appropriation necessary, and we'll argue that. You know, I'm going to work one more session. I get to do that with you for another go-around.
But you retired.
I did, but I think you need to have this argument, and I'll help you do it.
You're back.
Anyway, if we could delete the Section 4, Sub 2, and if we could clarify the current service level question, and then also adjust the payment schedule, and I think it takes simple language to do that, for the balance of 0203, this works pretty good.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ozzy, will it work for those few districts that still are on a cash basis?
It will vary. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Troll. Again, I've talked with some. It will vary. I know one district pays their last payment of salaries to employees in June for they pay 3 months, June, July, and August. They're in discussions to, we won't do that anymore, we'll pay June, July, and August. That helps their cash in June. This picks it up and they have the cash. And so others have better ending balances than others. And again, it's not going to work perfect. Some are going to have to borrow some money. And also, I think this will push more of them back onto an accrual where they, in theory, that's where we wanted them anyway, all of them on accrual. And this will help some of them get there.
Some of them may lose a little interest money on money.
Yeah, to the extent they have to borrow money that last 45 days, 60 days, depends how long they have to borrow it for, they're going to pay some interest.
Yes. They also may be making some money on hand.
That's true.
Further questions for Mr. Reyes? John, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I would reiterate and agree with everything that Ozzy said and everything that he suggested. It's difficult to look at an idea like this in isolation, and I would have to frankly tell you that in isolation, this is not a very good idea because it is going to impose some burdens on school districts and create some difficulty in trying to manage budget in view of dollars that aren't being received within the confines of a fiscal year. But we're hopeful that this component will be a part of a larger package that when we're all finished here, that we can look back with some pride and say we did the best we could given the political circumstances under which we're operating. I think there's an important factor to note, and this has particularly to do with the suggestion that the May payment, that the cut come in May of 03. School districts will have to borrow, and by creating the deficit in May and the possibility of borrowing in anticipation of the repayment of that loan in July is a 60-month note. and that's going to have a lot less costs for a lot of school districts that really don't like to borrow. Maybe they've eaten down their reserves, and they're not interested in issuing tax anticipation notes. So they may go to the local bank or figure out some other way to do just a short-term borrowing. And by structuring this so that they're borrowing for 60 days rather than a year, we'll have some substantial interest savings. Many other medium to larger size school districts will issue tax anticipation notes, and they'll look forward to getting their money in early July, repaying it on the following July 30, now that we're extending that opportunity for that repayment to 13 months, and they will issue that debt at tax-exempt rates and then invest it until they need it at market rates. And if that gap is significant enough, then they will be able to earn interest enough to totally pay the interest cost as well as the other cost of issuance of those TANs. So I think the 13 months is important, and we would strongly suggest that you take out the sunset because it does comply with federal law. Again, I appreciate the work that Cindy's done and Steve and Paul's willingness to involve us in looking at how to make what may otherwise seem a not very good idea, at least a workable one. And we believe that all the issues that we raised earlier in opposing this idea in the first special session have been fixed to our satisfaction, so it will be workable. That's not to say that it won't create some angst among school districts that are going to have to make some modifications, but at least we believe that the worst is has been fixed.
Mr. Chair, John meant that they've been fixed to his satisfaction if you do the things I want you to do.
Pardon me. editorial comment notwithstanding, I was curious to know, it looked to me that there was a conscious decision to create a window for the 13-month borrowing that would begin with obligations that were issued after the effective date of this bill and that would end in July 2005, and that window, I think they're specific to providing some bridging opportunities for people that had obligations that were current obligations that would last beyond the fiscal year. But I guess I would ask, I don't see Cindy, why the 13-month was put in and why the window was installed and what the purpose of the sunset was. I mean, obviously somebody thought about putting that sunset date in there, and I was curious to know if there was an explanation that we could get for why that was sunset of 2005. Well, there was a very specific date, third special session to July 2005, for a couple of years.
I thought I caught from Steve that they were anticipating that somehow they were going to adjust their accounting.
Or something.
Anybody have a clue?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a good clue as to the 2005. The January date was chosen so that there would at least be one more session, or it would fall after the 05 session, or deciding whether the sunset would be continued, or whether it would sunset, or whether the sunset would be postponed.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Rhodes?
I wasn't involved in the earlier discussions. I don't know why they chose to do that, other than the IRS allowed to go to the 13 months. And our argument is built on kind of Steve's comments that you're creating some financial options for districts. The 13 month is the standard for IRS. And why not let school districts manage their money and have this tool in the future, as well as just for this transition period, as long as we're going to make the change?
Yeah, at this point, if that's consistent with federal code, that seems to be a compelling argument. I just wanted to hear the other side of that pancake and find out, you know, there was a window. Somebody must have thought that that was a transitional period, and it's not apparent from the bill that that's why we have it. But your proposal would be to delete Section 4.
Would you delete subsection 2 or just the words end prior to July 1? 2012.
Could you restate that, Senator? I didn't hear you.
Well, it seems to me you'd want to leave subsection 2, at least up to the point on line 17, ending with the word act. So you delete it and prior to July 1st, 2005. Is that getting the gist of what you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, excuse me, all those obligations have already been, it doesn't make any difference, I don't think, Senator, because the ones already been issued, their time period's up, so you're only talking about ones. So I don't think it makes any difference one way or the other.
So wouldn't there be any obligations that were incurred, say, 9 months ago that upon effective date of the fact?
But they're already...
I don't think so.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, TANs that were issued last July are due and payable on this June 30.
Mm. So they would have been.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're inside of what we've got a 12-month limit on.
Right.
Okay. So it's basically a wash. Okay. Don't need it. It's gone. It's fine. Unless Cindy comes up with a really good idea.
Yeah, and that's, you know, precisely what I was thinking. There may be a reason, so if we could find
a... This is a special session. We ought to ask legislative council to stay in the room.
If we do that, they'll ask us not to modify their bills without...
They're
here to watch.
I grew up in the old school here where legislative council sat in the room and helped you change the bill.
That was when they used to... Chip these things into slates with a steel.
No, but you amended the bill right in committee and basically moved the bill. You didn't jack around with waiting 3 days for amendments.
I think that was before we reduced the number of legislative council that we had.
Either that or the volume of bills increased.
Yeah, well, that's it, okay. Too. Yeah, but we did reduce the staff.
3,500 LCs. Any other questions for the...
Are we having dinner here tonight?
Well, I think we ought to discuss that issue as we finish with this bill. The FERS issue looms before us, and I have not the impression that the committee members want to stay here until 10 o'clock tonight in public testimony. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. So what we'll do is just, I'll poll the members about the FERS issue is a big issue. It's something that's very important. I've been given leave to hold the morning hearing on it. If we want to reconvene tomorrow morning, tomorrow after a decent, reasonable interval. How long does it take you to get around, John?
Tomorrow morning's fine with me.
So we could begin the hearing this evening, at least identify and outline some of the significant issues, and then come back, say it's... We're not scheduled to be in committee or in floor session until 3 o'clock.
What?
Or is it 1 o'clock?
I thought it was
10. I thought it said 1, but
I thought it was 10 a.m.
I've been underground. I have no clue.
Someone,
do we have any more witnesses on this bill?
Are there any more? If there are more witnesses that would like to offer testimony in Senate Bill 1022, please come forward.
All right.
Hearing and seeing that. I think we're just waiting for Cindy to come and tell us there really was no significant issue, or there was.
Okay.
We'll close the public hearing.
We could call Lane Shetterly. He probably knows.
Maybe. I don't know about him. So the question is, colleagues, if we do end up, and I think we will, going into Senate Bill 1021 now, what do you think a reasonable period? Yeah, probably not reasonable. Senator Trump.
If we're not going to be home by 6 o'clock, then I can stay late. So it's fine with me if you want to stay.
Senator Duke? I don't anticipate that we're going to be moving the bill this evening.
Yes.
Yes, Senate convenes tomorrow at 1 p.m.
1 o'clock?
Yes.
Dude, so we can meet like at 10.
Well, that'd work fine, wouldn't it?
9 is too early?
Too early for me.
Okay.
And
I got to get my beauty sleep.
I didn't know when people.
One life, a banana, most of the bunch.
Yeah, I mean, right. The only thing is a motel room.
How long are you going to save my life?
I was thinking maybe 7 o'clock would be.
When's the Sunny Day party?
7 o'clock.
Oh, she is?
All right. Then let's go ahead and leave off on the, just go to, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1022. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1021, and we'll come back to 1022. Yeah, Senator?
We have a 1 hour.
No, we're already past the meeting, and it's immediate notification.
Okay.
I thought you said.
I need to make a call.
Four.
Oh, after four?
Yeah.
Are we recessed?
Corner.
Yeah, it's fine. Are we recessed?
We're going to take a 5-minute recess when we come back.